session number 26369, Reel 1.
Philip Dawkins, Reel 1. Can you tell me, please, when and where you were born?
28th of June, 1924.
And whereabouts?
Folkestone.
And were you brought up in Folkestone?
Yes.
And can you tell me about your family circumstances?
Well, my father had been a regular soldier, an RSM, and he worked after that for a mineral water company firm in Folkestone until the mid-30s, and then unfortunately lost his job, and for a couple of years he was unemployed. Then he found further work with another mineral water factory, and when the war came he had changed his job again to work for a coal merchant. And in 1940, the coal merchant closed down because Folkestone was in the firing line and there wasn't much work. And he got a job as a civil servant at Shawcliffe Camp, which suited him because he was back in the military background. And he remained there till he retired. So that was really sometime in the 50s, I suppose, and he died in 1954.
And did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had an elder brother who was 10 years older than me, and he was educated at the same prep school that I went to, and he eventually worked for the local newspaper in an accounting capacity, and that was his job for life.
And where did you go to school?
Well, we went to a small prep school in Folkestone, the Malvern House, and from there I went on to the Harvey Grammar School, and I left at the age of 16 to join the Midland Bank.
And was that in Folkestone?
That was in Hythe, just along the coast.
And what kind of things did you do in your spare time outside school?
Well, I was very keen on sport. I read a great deal. Used to go cycling a lot. Fond of games like chess, bridge. That's about it, really.
And how did you feel in the late 1930s as war was on the horizon?
Well, a bit depressed.
Were you quite aware of that?
Oh yes, very much aware of it. Particularly in 39 when... do you know Folkestone at all? The Lees, it's a big cliff-top promenade with lots of deck chairs. And normally, in the height of summer in August, it would have been full with holiday makers, but there were hardly any about, you know. It's quite depressing. And I remember going to watch a cricket match. This was on the Thursday before Poland was invaded. And during the match, a telegraph boy came out and went to one of the players, handed him a telegram, and the chap walked off with him, obviously, called up. So that didn't improve morale particularly, but there it was, I mean, it happened.
And do you remember hearing about the outbreak?
Oh yes, very much so.
Were you listening to the radio broadcast?
Yeah. And in the afternoon, I walked up onto the Lees, and there was a big convoy going down the channel with destroyers fussing around, so war was very much with us.
And how did you come to join the army?
Well, I was called up. My group was 50, and I waited for that. And I was called up in November 42, 5th of November actually.
What kinds of things were you doing in the intervening 2 or 3 years?
Well, I was beginning my career in banking. Curious life, I mean, in 1940, I used to go down by bus every day with German bombers overhead. It was the Battle of Britain, and so it was a strange life.
Yes, what do you recall of that summer?
Oh, quite a bit. I mean, I recall seeing vapor trails over the French coast as German bombers assembled to come over, and you would see them passing above. Occasionally there'd be a dogfight, occasionally there'd be a lot of anti-aircraft fire. One particular episode, which was very exciting really, was actually on Battle of Britain Bay, and there was a Messerschmitt flying just off the coast, off the East Cliff, and out of the blue a Spitfire came racing up and tore straight at it with its guns blazing. Wonderful sight. Shot it down, actually.
And was Folkestone bombed?
Folkestone was bombed. Not heavily, but it was bombed. Dover was the worst place, but Hythe, we had one or two bombs, but nothing much. But we lived in Folkestone, and this was after the Battle of Britain was over. In November 1940, one night, I heard a plane fly over very low, and the noise dwindled away, but there was another strange noise, and what it was actually, it dropped two parachute mines, and I could hear the swaying in the breeze somehow. And suddenly there was an almighty blast, and all the windows went out, and the roof went off, and one landmine landed about a couple of hundred yards from us. And luckily there was a high wall across the road which shielded us from the worst of the blast, otherwise it would have demolished our house. So we were bombed out. And we moved down to live in Hythe for the rest of the war.
And you joined the army, you were called up in 1942?
Yes.
And what unit did you join?
Well, first of all, every conscript went to a primary training wing for 6 weeks, initial training. So I went up to Strensor, near York, for that. And it really just consisted of square bashing and getting used to rifle and brain gun. Doing PT, that was the gist of it. And also you had aptitude tests, written tests, sort of IQ tests. And as a result of those, I was chosen as a potential officer. And then at the end of the course, I was posted to the signals at Prestatyn in North Wales. The old holiday camp there. And after a week or two there, I liked training as a wireless operator, and I decided to withdraw from the potential officer status. And I had 6 months training there on wireless operating and operating a small 10-line military exchange, and learning Morse code, obviously, and wireless procedure. And at the end of that, I was graded the standard grade for a wireless operator, B3. But this was upgraded very quickly to B2. I never knew why, but there it was more money, so. And from there I was posted to Blandford, to the 38th Welsh Divisional Signals, and on arrival at Blandford I found they'd moved to Kent, so I had to go on to Kent. And I was sent to 115 Brigade Signals in Dover Castle, and I was there for the period from May till September. We had a signal office down in the underground workings where all the other command posts were. But it was just a training division, really. We did one or two exercises, and I remember we felt very safe in the castle, and nothing ever seemed to land there. We used to stand on the ramparts and watch the shells fall in the town. Peculiar. And there were one or two air raids, but nothing much. And we left Dover in the September, moved to the Chalfonts for a few weeks, and then up to Wooler in Northumberland. And after I'd been at Wooler for about a fortnight, I received orders to report to STS 54A at Henley-on-Thames. And I wondered what the hell an STS was. No one knew. So I spent the whole day journeying down from Wooler to Henley, arriving late at night. And next morning I found I was in SOE, and I signed the Official Secrets Act. And I was at a place called Fawley Court, but I was only there for a few days, learning SOE wireless procedure, which was quite different from the Army wireless procedure. It was really a variation on the commercial Q code. And I was assessed on my operating ability, and some of us moved into Henley itself to a three-storey house near Finnis Court, which is the end of Henley-on-Thames, nearest to Fawley Court. And we started setting up this new unit, Special Force Number 2, Signal Section, which was destined to be attached to the Canadians for the invasion of Europe. And we also made acquaintance with the B2 set. Have you heard of the B2? Which was very glamorous to us, really, as it was the set used by the agents in occupied Europe. And I suppose we were there till January, when we moved to Forthampton House in Forthampton near Tewkesbury for further training. And there we met up with our transport section, which was composed of Royal Armoured Corps personnel. And we started going out on mobile exercises using the B2 just to get used to it. And after a few weeks, we moved on to Stodden Park, which is near Liss in Hampshire, actually the home of Sir Reginald Dorman Smith, the governor of Burma, and Lady Dorman Smith was still in residence there. And that just meant further training and fitness training, and we were there for a few weeks. And in May, we moved up to Walton on the Hill under canvas to wait for the invasion. Could I take a break?
How did you feel in May 1944 with the invasion imminent?
Raring to go, funnily enough. We all had a medical before we went to Warton on the Hill, and I was not A1. I was a lower grade because I had flat feet. And the doctor said, well, everyone going should be A1. You really should withdraw. And I said, I don't want to withdraw, you know, I want to go. So he agreed, but that shows that I was happy in the unit. I was happy at the prospect of what we had to do, and I just wanted to go.
Can you describe your objectives, how they were in your orders, how you were preparing to do your job?
Yes, well, our job was to go with the Canadians and to provide a link between the Canadian Army and the resistance. And this link would be maintained in various ways, mainly by wireless, and not directly, usually with the resistance. You would send your message back to London or to the SOE wireless base, and they would transmit to the particular resistance group in question. But I have a feeling sometimes that physical contact may have been made by resistant agents coming through the lines and meeting our intelligence officers. But beyond that, the purpose was also to advise the army commander on the best possible use of resistance forces on his sector and targets which they might be able to destroy or damage, that sort of thing.
Can we go back a little bit to June 1944?
Yes.
And can you describe the circumstances by which you arrived in France?
Well, we were waiting, as I say, and D-Day came. And then, I think it was a day later, the V1s started coming over in force, so we saw a lot of those. But about a week after D-Day, we got the order to move, and we went up in convoy through London to Tilbury. And we embarked on a Liberty ship there, and came down through the Straits of Dover by night, with V1s going overhead, and arrived at Juno Beach the following afternoon, landed the next day. An advance party had gone ahead of us, so there was transport waiting for us, but we were only about 2 or 3 miles inland at a place called Ambly, A-M-B-L-I-E, where a camp had already been set up. And we got there, and we started work immediately, transmitting back to London. And we kept going pretty busy, really, for about a fortnight. Then it slackened off a bit.
Can you recall your first impressions of landing in France?
Yes. Quite impressive, because there was such a vast concourse of shipping all the way down off Juno Beach down to Aramarsh. It was thick with transports of every description and small craft plying from ship to shore and shore to ship. Ducks, you know what a duck is, yes. Rhinos, do you know what a rhino is?
Could you describe those two?
Well, a rhino is a big, flat landing craft for cramming as much transport on as possible to offload onto the shore. And, of course, landing craft of every description, ferrying supplies in or troops or whatever. And, you know, it's most awesome scene. And we anchored near the American cruiser Houston, which was busily bombarding targets ashore. So those are the first impressions, exciting. And next day we went ashore by landing craft and trudged up the beach. And you could hear the sounds of artillery fire from round Car, I should think. But as I say, Ombly was only 2 or 3 miles inshore, and I think we were probably about 5 or 6 miles from the front line.
And how did the job proceed? How did your work? Was it carried out in the weeks that followed?
Yes, we were kept busy. There was a lot of wireless traffic coming in and going out. I mean, being a wireless operator, you very seldom know what you're sending or what you're receiving because it's all in cipher. We had been taught the one-time pad. You've heard of that, the one-time pad code. We had a large cipher section, but there were occasions when, say, perhaps we were on detachment duty, when we needed to do our own encoding and decoding.
Can you describe how that would work?
No. No, I'm sorry, I've forgotten. Very, very simple. I mean, I think you took a line from a book or something and used that, but the mechanics of it I've forgotten, I'm afraid. I never used it again, whereas I could still operate a Morse key. The code has gone.
Can you describe the size and setup of the unit in which you were in?
Yes. I'm just trying to think. Have you got the... If I could have the... Okay. Well, we had two officers, a captain who was the OC and a second in command who was a lieutenant, both Royal Signals. Our overall CO of the whole detachment, which I mean, there was an operations and intelligence section and a signal section. The overall CO was a French-Canadian, and the adjutant was also a French-Canadian. And there were quite a few French Canadians, obviously, because they spoke French, you know. We had a section sergeant. Cipher sergeants, we had, I should say, 10, I'm not quite sure. Wireless operators, we had 14. We were split into what we called a heavy section and two light sections. The heavy section was static at HQ, but the light sections were mobile and moved out and about on detachment. We had an instrument mechanic, and that was it, really. That's referring to the Royal Signals personnel. The Royal Armoured Corps, we had 6 drivers, 3 dispatch riders. We had 2 Royal Army Service Corps drivers, and we had an Army Catering Corps cook.
And what were the vehicles that you were moving around in?
Well, initially, for the light section, we had Humber staff cars, but when we went across, they'd been replaced by what the Army calls gin palaces, which are wireless vehicles. Don't ask me why they're called gin palaces. But they were more useful than the staff cars. The heavy section had American equipment, a large receiver vehicle and a transmitter vehicle, which was set about 1/2 mile apart and connected by landline. So those were the vehicles we had. And the dispatch riders, I think they had a mixture of Harley Davidson and BSA motorbikes. So.
And how close were you behind the frontline troops as the Canadians moved?
We were generally about anything from 3 to 6 miles. If we were on light section detachment, we might well be much closer.
Can you describe how a light section would operate?
Well, you would take one vehicle, one driver, two wireless operators, a cipher sergeant in all probability, and the intelligence officer would take his own vehicle. There might be two of them. And you would just go to a location, it might be in the village, it might be out in the country somewhere, and you would set up your wireless station, put up a radio mast, or just throw the aerial up over a tree, and the intelligence people would generally go off to contact whoever they had to. Sometimes people would come in to them, but generally they disappeared somewhere for a while and came back and gave you work, you know, traffic to transmit back. That was the usual drill.
How safe were you that close to the front line?
Pretty safe, really. If you were unlucky, you might get some artillery fire, but I mean, if you're unwise and shove the wireless aerial up too high, you probably would get some artillery fire. But we only had one casualty throughout the whole campaign.
Can you describe the circumstances by which that casualty was occurred?
Well, yes, it was a driver, and he backed his vehicle onto the verge, and a landmine was there, so that was his bad luck. You know. He wasn't killed, but one of the intelligence officers was killed, but I don't know the circumstances of that. But of course, they were going much nearer the enemy.
Did you see any of the French resistance yourself?
We saw them occasionally, yes, in the villages, perhaps. You know.
So how close was the liaison between your units and the resistance?
Oh, very close. Mm. I mean, the resistance were encouraged to come in and contact our people.
Were there sometimes JEDBRA units or other SOE officers with these units, do you think?
Not with us. They may well have been with the resistance, but they would be over behind the lines, I would imagine. I mean, JEDBRAs would drop behind the lines. And, personally, I never had contact with any JEDBRAs.
How effective do you think your units were in liaising with the resistance?
Well, it's very difficult to say from wireless operator because you don't really know that much. I think